From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the story behind a forgotten Irish-American songwriting team, Harrigan and Bram. They wrote songs about New York for the stage in the late 1800s, before Tin Pan Alley. Singer, guitarist, and Irish folklorist Mick Maloney has revived their songs on a new CD. He'll join us to play and talk about the music. Frank Lesser wrote the musicals Guys and Dolls and How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying. The New York City Opera is reviving one of his lesser-known musicals, The Most Happy Fellow. We'll talk with his widow, Jo Sullivan Lesser, who starred in the original 1956 production. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When I saw Mick Maloney's new CD paying tribute to the songs of Ed Harrigan, I wondered, was it the same Harrigan that James Cagney sang about in the film Yankee Doodle Dandy when Cagney played the vaudevillian George M. Cohan?
H-A-W-R-I-G-A-N
spells Harrigan.
Proud of all the Irish blood that's in me, and devil a man can say a word agin me.
H-A-W-R-I-G-A-N-U-C
is a name that a shame never has been connected with Harrigan. That's me. H-A-W-R-I.
Yep, same Harrigan. George M. Cohan was one of Harrigan's great admirers. But why is a singer, guitarist, and Irish folklorist like Mick Maloney paying tribute? Well, it turns out the music by lyricist Harrigan and his songwriting partner David Brame is not only an important part of Irish-American music history, it's a fascinating example of early music theater in New York in the 1870s and 80s, before Tin Pan Alley. Mick Maloney's new CD is called McNally's Row of Flats, Irish-American Songs of Old New York by Harrigan and Brame. Maloney was born in Limerick and has lived in the U.S. since 1973. He has recorded and produced over 40 albums of traditional music. Mick Maloney, welcome to Fresh Air. I'd like you to introduce the first track on the new CD, which is called McNally's Row of Flats. Would you describe this as one of the really early songs about city life in America?
It is indeed one of the early songs about city life in America, and it comes out of the context of Lower East Side Manhattan, where Ed Harrigan lived along with David Brame. And this was a time in the early 1880s when this song was written, when Irish immigrants were living beside Italian immigrants, and they were also living beside African Americans and Chinese immigrants. Eastern European immigrants were arriving, mostly Jewish, from Russia and Ukraine. And the whole thing was a real multicultural mosaic. And this song gives a very good flavor of that.
Okay, a song about multiculturalism long before anybody invented the word. Here it is, McNally's Row of Flats.
Down in Bottle Alley lived Timothy McNally, a decent politician and a gentleman at that. Beloved by all the ladies, the gossoons and the babies that occupy the building called McNally's Row of Flats. And it's Ireland and Italy, Jerusalem and Germany, Chinese and Africans, and a paradise for rats. All jumbled up together in the snow and rainy weather, they constitute the tenants in McNally's Row of Flats. That great conglomeration of men from every nation, the Tower of Babylonium, it couldn't equal that. A peculiar institution were the brogues without dilution. They rattled on together in McNally's Row of Flats. And it's Ireland and Italy, Jerusalem and Germany, Chinese and Africans, and a paradise for rats, all jumbled up together in the snow and rainy weather. They constitute the tenants in McNally's Row of Flats.
That's Mick Maloney from his new CD, McNally's Row of Flats, Irish American Songs of Old New York by Harrigan and Brame. Would you just place us musically here? I mean, this is an era, we're talking like 1870s to 1890s.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's kind of precedes Tin Pan Alley.
It does, yes.
So what are the entertainments of the time?
Well, you would think of Gilbert and Sullivan around that era. That's the late 1870s. Actually, Harrigan and Brame started writing songs about 6 or 7 years before Gilbert and Sullivan. Some of the songs have somewhat of the same feel to them. Of course, Gilbert and Sullivan go into opera and operetta, and Harrigan and Brame and Hart, they stick with musical comedy, musical theatre. But say a song like, say, The Mulligan Guard, which was their first big hit. If you look at it, the sheet music, it will go something like this. We crave your condescension, we'll tell you what we know. From marching in the Mulligan Guard and the Sligo Ward below. Our captain's name was Hussey, a Tipperary man. He shouldered, he shored like a Russian duke whenever he took command. We shouldered guns and marched away. From Baxter Street, we marched to Avenue A. Our fifes and
drums so sweetly they did play as we marched, marched, marched in the Mulligan Guard.
Now, when I went and listened to that in sheet music, it didn't sound like that much of a big deal. And I knew that it needed something as a window into the past to make it more evocative of the original feel of the music in its context. This was the era of marching bands, of course. So I went to Vince Giordano, who has a band, the Nighthawks, and they played for 15 years up in 48th and Broadway at Charlie O's. Big fan of their music.
They do swing tunes and early jazz.
Yeah, early jazz. And Vince is a great knowledge of early American music, especially 20th century music. This was a little bit before his time. But with him and his arranger, John Gill, who also plays in the band, we sort of step back another few decades at what might this have sounded like in a pit orchestra in the Harrigan and Hart and Brame era. You're talking about the 1870s. And we did what we felt would be a fairly decent reconstruction of what it would have sounded like then, with the feel, however, of today as well. Because the intent was never, when I started making this CD, the intent was never to reconstruct anything, but to more or less get the flavour of what it was like and then do it as if it would have been done today by Harrigan.
Well, why don't we hear how it sounds on your CD with Vince Giordano's band behind you? So this is the Mulligan Guards.
Your condescension, we'll tell you what we know of marching in the Mulligan Guard from the Sligo ward below. Our captain's name was Hussey, a Tipperary man. He carried his sword like a Rooshan duke whenever he took command.
Forward! March!
We shouldered guns and marched away. From Baxter Street, we marched to Avenue A. Our fifes and drums, so sweetly they did play, as we marched, marched, marched at the Mulligan Guard.
That's Mick Maloney from his new CD, McNally's Row of Flats, Irish-American Songs of Old New York by Harrigan and Brame. And that was Vince Giordano's band backing him up. Now, this song is about, what, a neighborhood militia?
A neighborhood militia, because after the Civil War, there were a lot of people dressed up and nowhere to go. And the whole idea of having militias that will go and do target shooting really proliferated in New York. Dickens wrote a lot about it. He was appalled by the number of people who clogged up the arterial routes of Manhattan any given Sunday. Basically an excuse to have a big picnic and drink a lot. And a lot of these target companies, as they were called, were ethnically and fraternally based and often based in particular neighbourhoods. So they were very competitive. So the whole idea was really to go and do some target shooting. But that somehow got overwhelmed by the idea of having a big party, lots of drunkenness. And it was a very New York, a very urban New York. So this was satire from the very start. And the strange thing about it was that the song became the most popular song ever for Ed Harrigan and David Brame. And it was taken up by almost all the military bands. John Philip Sousa's band played it, Gilmore's band played it. It was even played in all the British regimental bands. And Kipling, in his novel Kim, even mentions a regimental British band in India playing the Mulligan Guard. He even quotes the first chorus. I doubt if that old imperialist would have known it was written by an Irish-American as a send-up of the military.
Now, the lyricist for the songs that you do on your new CD, mm-hmm. Ed Harrigan, was part of a duo with Tony Hart. They had an act that they did in minstrel shows.
They did. They both started out as minstrels. And if you were an entertainer in urban America in the 1860s or really any time before that, after 1840, you really didn't have a whole lot of options. You had to black up if you wanted to be a professional musician. And Harrigan did that. Also, Tony Hart, whose original name was Anthony Cannon, he was an immigrant from County Mayo. Ed Harrigan was born in Manhattan in 1844, and Anthony Cannon, who became Tony Hart, was born in 1855 in Massachusetts near Boston. And they met up in Chicago and they teamed up and they became known as the team of Harrigan and Hart. So they moved from minstrels to variety theatre, from there to musical, to inventing musical theatre.
What do you mean when you say that they invented musical theatre?
Before that time, variety theatre had presented music and song and dance along with sketches as part of one long evening of sequential acts and entertainment. What they did, beginning with the expansion of the Mulligan Guard idea, was to create one full-length exposition, a play if you want, with music and dance and song woven into the play and adding characters all the time. So the Mulligan Guard starts off as three people. By the time it's gone through its six different incarnation, there's a cast of over 25 different people. And they represent ethnic New York. There's Walshingham McSweeney, who owns the saloon. There's Gustavus Luckmuller, the German butcher. There's At Wong, the Chinese laundryman, who also has an opium den, and there's a cast of Irish characters, and it expands, representing in a sense, I suppose, the first realism in theatre in New York, in that New York was being given itself back on stage for the first time in a comprehensive way. And Harrigan went and bought clothes in secondhand stores. He went even to the immigrant ships coming in, and he bought the clothes off the backs of the immigrants, so you could arrive in America on a Monday and see your shirt up on stage on a Saturday night. It was that realistic, and he very deliberately sought to represent New York, but in a very good-humoured way.
We're describing Harrigan's music as preceding Tin Pan Alley. Mm-hmm. You know, in Tin Pan Alley in its early years was really dominated by a lot of Jewish songwriters like the Gershwins and Irving Berlin. Is it fair to say that before there were so many popular Jewish songwriters, there were a lot of popular Irish songwriters?
There were a lot of popular Irish songwriters and also a lot of very popular Jewish and Irish teams of songwriters. When you hear of songs, for instance, like the one that was a big hit in Ireland some years back, My Irish Molly O, that was written by Jerome and Schwartz.
Really?
Who also wrote If It Weren't for the Irish and the Jews. You would think, well, Jerome and Schwartz, they're surely two Jewish songwriters. Well, they weren't. Bill Jerome was actually William Flannery from County Mayo. And nobody knew exactly how the entertainment industry was going to go in the 1890s. And people were hedging their bets. And some people like William Flannery said, well, it's definitely going Jewish. I'm Bill Jerome. Where Nora Goldberg arrives from Milwaukee. And she says, I don't know which way this is going. I'm changing my name to Nora Bays. And I'm going to sing, has anybody here seen Kelly, K-E-double-L-Y. So it went in both directions. And then after 1900, there was a lot of the Jewish Irish songwriting team in the early years of Tin Pan Alley, more or less supplanted later on by Jewish songwriters. But there was that whole two decades where there was kind of an ambiguity.
It sounds like one of the reasons why Harrigan lost his audience is that the audience changed, like the ethnic makeup of the audience.
They
changed.
Did, and Harrigan lost touch with his biggest asset was his powers as a wordsmith, and his sense of humor, which was tied to that. And he became middle class himself. But the old neighborhoods stopped being Irish and African American and German, and particularly immigrants came in from Eastern Europe who were Jewish. And Harrigan complained in his writing that these people, he said, had no sense of humour. And of course, he was completely wrong. He knew nothing about Yiddish theatre. He just wasn't, the humour wasn't available to him because of linguistic reasons and cultural reasons. So he lost touch with the old neighbourhoods, and New York changed and humour changed. And also the recording industry was in now in the late 1890s, and tastes were changing, as they always do in America. And in popular culture, you have a few options. You can reinvent yourself, which he wasn't able to do, he's just too old. You can wait until your time comes around again. And he was too old for that. Or you can just fade away, which is exactly what he did.
My guest is Mick Maloney. His new CD is called McNally's Row of Flats. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Mick Maloney. His new CD is called McNally's Row of Flats, Irish American Songs of Old New York by Harrigan and Bram. In rediscovering the songs of Harrigan and Bram, did you find yourself rethinking a lot of songs from early American pop history? And I'm wondering if there are any songs that you maybe used to dismiss as kind of commercial or schmaltzy or, you know, silly, that once discovering more about their history, decided are actually pretty interesting.
Well, yes, and I think the more you learn about the social context of the songs, and the more you learn about why people bought into an idealized notion of a homeland, because, I mean, the horrors of the real story were too much to deal with in day-to-day life. You can't just relive trauma all your life. Life would literally be hell. It wouldn't be worth living. So Tin Pan Alley specialized in creating these sanitized images of homelands for so many immigrant populations in America. I think once I started to realize that, and once I started to talk to people who love the songs, and realized that their grandparents had at least something positive to say, even if it was an invented reality, I started to feel very sympathetic towards the songs, some that I might have dismissed completely. This is one in case, and in fact, this was the classic Jewish-Irish Tin Pan Alley songwriting team of Dubin and O'Brien. I'll see if I can remember this now. Oh, you should have seen the sights I saw, 'twas just the other night. Oh, you never saw the likes of it, 'twas such a pleasing sight. I was happy for a moment, but now I'm feeling blue. For what I saw I'll see no more, 'twas too good to be true. Oh, the shamrocks are blooming on Broadway. Every girl is an Irish Colleen. And the streets of New York are the county of Cork. All the buildings are painted green. Sure, the Hudson is just like the Shannon. Oh, how good and how real it did seem. I could hear mother singing, the sweet Shandon bells are ringing. 'Twas only an Irishman's dream. And I see a beauty in that now that I would not have been able to see some years back.
When did you rediscover the song?
I always knew it, but I started to feel differently about it when I started to delve into the story of Immigrant Song and Tin Pan Alley. And when I started to ask myself the question, why did this resonate with so many Americans for so long? And I realized this was a time of extraordinary social transition from an old country to a new country, an old way of life to a new way of life, from the countryside to the city. And this was a time when America was urbanizing at a tremendous rate. It wasn't just America, foreign-born people who identified with these songs, anybody from the countryside. Songs about that which is that left behind, which was idealized.
Harrigan starts off as a minstrel performer. He performed in blackface, as you mentioned. Is he still performing in blackface when he's writing his own shows and performing them in New York? And if so, like, what's the context of the blackface?
Well, he is. And all the way through his career, he continues to perform in blackface. In fact, the Mulligan Guard was his most famous set of characters. And right parallel to the Mulligan Guard and all the Mulligan Guard series was the Skidmore Guard, which was an African-American target company. And they would come in contact often with a lot of what they call knockabouts, brawling on the stage. Of course, it was the same cast in blackface, and that never stopped. One of the reasons Harrigan said in his own comments later was that he admired African-American music and he admired the capacity for singing and dancing. But of course, it was still a minstrel representation. There were no African-Americans at all on the stage.
Do you know any of the songs that he wrote for any of the blackface songs?
I know a lot. I know of them. And in fact, there's a wonderful book with 200 Harrigan songs that are now edited by Joss Finson. And I wouldn't touch most of those songs. They're very racist by the standards of today. Would be considered quite the norm at that time in the minstrel tradition.
Now, does that bother you? Does that get in your way of enjoying Harrigan's songs?
It does to some degree. When you look at the whole body of work, there's such a strong minstrel component in it. And of course, that's bothersome because it's racist. There's no two ways about it. It was of its time. And I think minstrelsy is a very complex chapter in American musical and in social history. And I certainly would find it very, very difficult to sing any of those songs.
I want to close with another song from your CD, and this is really a lovely waltz called Danny by My Side. Would you tell us about the song?
Yes, it was written just a few years after the Brooklyn Bridge was built by the Roeblings, designed one of the great structures in late 19th century America, in a sense of almost a symbol of what American ingenuity could create. And it was, as well as being a highly utilitarian structure, you know, increased the traffic flow between Brooklyn and Manhattan exponentially. It was just a beautiful sight, and people came from all over America to look at it, and indeed from all over the world to walk across the Brooklyn Bridge, and it was the talk of the day. And Harrigan, of course, grew up just a few hundred yards from there. He didn't miss the opportunity to write it. I think one of his most beautiful songs, Danny by My Side. And Bill McComiskey came up from Baltimore. Dana Lynn, who's originally from Los Angeles, played the fiddle, and Brendan Dolan played the piano. We had a great time.
Mick, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you very much. It was an honor.
And here's another track from Mick Maloney's new CD, McNally's Row of Flats, Irish American Song in Old New York by Harrigan and Bram. And this is Danny by My Side.
The Brooklyn Bridge on Sunday is known as Lover's Lane. I stroll there with my sweetheart, oh, time and time again. It's then I love to ramble, oh yes, it is my pride. Dressed in my best, each day of rest, with Danny by my side. Then oh my, do try taking the bridge on a Sunday, laughing, chaffing, happy the lovers go by. Moonlight, starlight, watching the silvery tide. Dressed in my best, each day of rest, with Danny by my side.
Music from Mick Maloney's new CD, McNally's Row of Flats, Songs of Old New York by Harrigan and Bram. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Go out to take the
support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of The Count of Monte Cristo, introduced by Luke Sant, available in stores and online. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, with the new website at macfound.org. And from Delta Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Into the Blue, a novel of psychological suspense set in Britain by Robert Goddard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Everyone who loves music theater knows Frank Lesser's musical Guys and Dolls. A wonderful Lesser musical that isn't nearly as well known, The Most Happy Fella, is now being revived by the New York City Opera. Coming up, we meet Lesser's widow, Jo Sullivan Lesser. She starred in the original 1956 production.
I got the horse right here, the name is Paul Revere, and here's a guy that says if the weather's clear, can do, this guy says the horse can do, if he says the horse can do, can do.
I pick him Valentine, cause on the morning line, the guy has got him figured at 5 to 9.
But his epitaph, he wins it by a half, according to this here and that telegraph.
For Paul Revere, I'll fight, I hear his sports all right. Of course, it all depends if it rained last night.
I know it's Valentine, cause on the morning line, the guy has got him figured at 5 to 9.
But just a minute.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Frank Lesser wrote the great musicals Guys and Dolls and How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying. One of his musicals that isn't nearly as well known is now being revived by the New York City Opera. It's called The Most Happy Fella, and it's about as different from Guys and Dolls as a musical can be. The Most Happy Fella is inspired by Italian opera. It's set in the Depression, in a California vineyard, where a lonely waitress becomes the mail order bride of an older man, who she betrays, only to later truly fall in love with him. My guest is the star of the original 1956 Broadway production, who later became Lesser's wife, Jo Sullivan Lesser. Here she is from the original cast recording. She's just told her husband that she's pregnant with another man's baby, and although she now loves her husband deeply, she knows she must leave him.
Please let me tell you that I love you. Just one more time before I go. Please let me tell you that I love you, 'cause it happens to be so.
Jo Sullivan got the part in The Most Happy Fella while she was performing in the first New York production of the Three Penny Opera with Lottie Lenya.
The producers saw me, and then they dragged Frank down to see me. And then after that, I auditioned about 20 times. And in those days, there were about three of us that sang all the soprano roles. You know, in those days, the sopranos, the leading ladies, were little blondes. And one was Barbara Cook, and one was Florence Henderson, and one was myself. So we all auditioned, but I guess I was more Southern and sounded more like a waitress than the other two, so I got the part.
What did you do each of those 20 times? I mean, were the auditions different from time to time?
I would sing the same song some of the time, but he would have you do something that absolutely drove you nuts. He would have you sing Happy Birthday to You, and he would have you sing it higher and higher and higher and higher. We would have to go, "Happy birthday to you, happy birthday to you, happy birthday, happy birthday, happy birthday," till you almost hit the ceiling. And that's how he would find out, if you could go up there.
So what was he like to work with that first time before you were married to him? Did he give you a lot of direction about how he wanted the music sung or what he was thinking when he wrote it?
Frank gave everybody a lot of direction about how he wanted the music sung. He would tell us, make us stand and even tell us when he wanted us to raise our head or to raise our right hand. And naturally, he gave us a lot of very good vocal things to do. The words were very important to Frank too. He loved the words, because when he wrote a piece, he always wrote the words first, and then he would write a melody. And he used to say to me, "I don't pay any attention to this melody. It may not be the right one. It's just a dummy melody. Just listen to the words." So then, after he decided that the words were correct, then he would work on his music and develop that. And he was very, very particular to every single person in the cast about how they sang his music.
You know what I find interesting about that? There are so many composers who write dummy lyrics. They write lyrics that just kind of save the place. They're mock lyrics. And then after the melody is all done, they'll write the real lyrics. But I've never heard of a dummy melody before.
Well, I think that it's much more important to write the lyrics first, because in my book, the lyrics are the most important thing. I mean, that tells a story. That's what you really, really got to work on. And anybody that sings a song and holds up a sheet of music in front of them and doesn't know it and doesn't know the words, I figure is not singing the song.
I want to play more music from the original cast recording of Most Happy Fella, which you're in. And there's a song in this that's quite lovely called Somebody Somewhere. And this was actually a replacement song for a song that he had originally written called Wanting to Be Wanted. I'd like you to talk about both of those songs and why he decided not to use Wanting to Be Wanted.
Well, we didn't even know that Frank had written another song instead of Somebody Somewhere until about 10 or 12 years ago, because we were going through all of his music, organizing it correctly, making sure everything was exactly in the right place, exactly the right year, exactly for the right show. And we came upon this song, Wanting to Be Wanted. And it's such a beautiful song. And we were all amazed that he had written that and not used it. But then we looked at Somebody Somewhere and realized that he had taken the verse of Wanting to Be Wanted and used that, Wanted to Be Wanted, and then sang Somebody Somewhere for the chorus. And he was able to use both of them. And why he did it, I'll never know, but I guess he was just pleased with it, but, you know, was happier with it that way.
The original song, the one that he cast out and didn't use, is much darker than the replacement song that's in the show. And why don't we think about that as we hear them both back to back. First, we'll hear you in the original cast recording singing Somebody Somewhere, and then we'll hear you nearly 40 years later singing the original song, the darker song that Frank Lesser wrote, the one that he did not use for the show. So here's Joe Sullivan Lesser.
Wanting to be
That's Joe Sullivan Lesser singing two songs written by her late husband, Frank Lesser. The first is from the original cast recording of The Most Happy Fella, which was recorded in 1957. Then we heard her singing in a 1992 recording, a song that he wrote for the show but decided not to use. Now, it was during the making of The Most Happy Fella that you and your husband fell in love. I mean, you met through the show. I imagine that's when you fell in love, because you got married afterwards.
Yeah, we did, yes.
So at what point did you realize that you were more than his star and he was more than your director?
Well, you just couldn't work with Frank and not sort of fall in love with him. He was enchanting. I admired his work greatly. He was very, very funny. He was witty, and he was he was just a wonderful, wonderful human being to be with. And both of us were not exactly happy in the arrangements we had. Both of us were married. And so we just sort of got together after that. We spent so much time together during the show. We were out of town for 2 months before we opened in New York. And then I played the show a year and a half in New York. So we spent a lot of time together.
Did you try to keep it hidden during the show?
Well, of course. Everyone, naturally. But there was a spark there, I think. People sort of knew it. And we were married 2 years after the show, after I left the show in 1960. I have to think of the year. My. And it was wonderful. It was wonderful to be married to a composer. I didn't sing after that for 17 years because he didn't want me to sing. He wanted me to be with him and go where he went. And we had two beautiful children, two girls. And so, but it worked out fine. I was very happy.
Well, how did you feel about giving up performing? You have such a beautiful voice.
Well, thank you very much. I frankly didn't even think about it. I was very busy going to all the shows with them and listening to what was going on and seeing how things were working out and taking care of two children. And Frank was a handful, I have to say.
In what sense?
He demanded a lot of attention. He wanted to make sure we went on trips and listen to this. He wanted me to listen to that piece or listen to this piece and learn that piece for him and see if it sounded right. And I played the piano, and I would play parts of it for the piano with him to see if it was right. And he was a handful. He used to go to bed at 12 o'clock at night, and around 12, and get up at 4 in the morning. And from 4 in the morning till 8 o'clock in the morning, he would write and on a silent piano, thankfully. And that's because the telephone couldn't bother him. He could write and compose and be completely clear about that. He would also get in the car, and you would drive him around, and he would write in the car because the telephone couldn't get to him, too, at the same time. So then in the morning when I would get up, 7:30 or whatever, he would be having a martini and I would be having a cup of coffee because he'd been up for 4 hours. So he was having lunch and I was having breakfast. It was kind of a funny arrangement.
My guest is Joe Sullivan Lesser. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Joe Sullivan Lesser, the widow of Frank Lesser, and the star of the original 1956 production of his musical The Most Happy Fella. It's now being revived by the New York City Opera. Frank Lesser was a kind of interesting singer himself. He recorded some demos that were a few years ago put together on CD, and I really love that recording. So I thought we could pause here and listen to one of them. I thought we'd hear him singing something he wrote for Guys and Dolls, I'll Know. But before we hear it, what did you think of these demos? And did you have any of his demos when you were preparing to perform in Most Happy Fella?
No, we did not. We did not. But we put that album together to make sure that he sang. I thought he sang terrific. I mean, let's face it, he didn't have a very beautiful voice. But he certainly knew how to put a lyric over. I mean, you could see how important the lyrics were to him. And I think it shows on this album. I think it's great fun to listen to.
No, me too. Well, let's hear it. This is Frank Lesser singing one of his songs from Guys and Dolls, I'll Know.
I'll know when my love comes along. I'll know then and there. I'll know at the sight of her face. How I care, how I care, how I care. And I'll stop and I stare at I'm no.
That's Frank Lesser on an album of demo records that was put together called An Evening with Frank Lesser. My guest is his widow, the singer Jo Sullivan Lesser, and she was in the original production of his 1956 musical, The Most Happy Fellow, which is now being revived by the New York City Opera. You know, we heard Frank Lesser singing one of his songs. What was his attitude towards singers and musicians who took liberties with either his lyrics or the music? And I'm talking about on their own records. I'm not talking about when they were appearing in a production of one of his shows.
I don't think he cared when they were on a record. I know that he used to say to me, "Oh, let them do that. That song is so famous it doesn't make any difference." That would happen often. But if you did decide that you were going to do something and change the way you sang or whatever, his rhythm or whatever he wrote in a show, then there was a lot of trouble. And in How to Succeed, he had such a fight with Rudy Valley. You know, Rudy Valley had been singing for many, many years and said, "Listen, I don't need anybody to tell me how to sing a song." Well, Frank said, "Well, you're going to sing my song this way." They almost came to blows. But the fact was that Frank quit the show, which I, when he came home, I said to him, "I think you've gone a little far this time, Frank, for God's sakes." But he quit the show, and they had to beg him and cajole him to come back, and of course he did. And then when they were recording, when they made the movie of Guys and Dolls, Frank Sinatra would not sing the songs the way Frank wanted him to. And Frank wrote him a great song called Adelaide. And Sinatra and he never spoke after that. They had such a fight that they never spoke after that movie.
What exactly was the fight about?
Because Sinatra would not sing Frank's songs the way he wanted him to.
Melodically or lyrically?
He was going to croon them more than that, and Frank didn't like it and didn't think it suited the part.
Oh.
And I think he was right.
So who won in the movie of Guys and Dolls? Was it Sinatra or Frank Lesser?
I think that Sinatra sang it the way he wanted to.
Now, your husband, Frank Lesser, died at, what was he, like 59?
59 years old, yes.
Of lung cancer after you were married about 10 years.
Yes, we were.
And he left to you, what, his publishing company, which was publishing rights to all of his songs?
Yes. He left to me his publishing company. He was a superb businessman, and he'd built himself up a little empire. And he left me a company that leased shows to all the schools and stock and everything, and a publishing company. And in that publishing company, he had many young composers that he had helped and sponsored their careers. And one is Richard Adler, and who wrote Pajama Game with Jerry Ross. And that's a big hit on Broadway right now.
Mm-hmm.
And Meredith Wilson and Bob Wright and Chet Forrest and Charlie Strauss and all of these young men, he helped. And I really admired that a great deal. Frank's motto for composers was improve the breed. And he tried to. And I wish people would do that today. I wish somebody would really help all these wonderful young composers that are coming up. And give them money so they can write and they can work. So I wish somebody would do that.
So what were some of the difficult decisions you had to make about rights to his songs and rights to his musicals?
Well, I remember that he told me, first of all, we never allowed anyone to sing Adelaide's Lament on television. And Frank told me that don't let them sing the big songs too much. Save them for big moments because they'll ruin it. So I keep Luck Be a Lady. Every week, two or three times, somebody calls and wants to do Luck Be a Lady. And I don't let them do it. Very, very seldom do I.
My guest is Jo Sullivan Lesser. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
you're just joining us, my guest is Joe Sullivan Lesser. Her husband was Frank Lesser, the great songwriter, and she was in the original production of his musical, The Most Happy Fella, which is now being revived by the New York City Opera. And I should mention that the original cast recording from 1957 that Joe Sullivan Lesser is featured on is still in print and available. Before you did Frank Lesser's The Most Happy Fella, you were off-Broadway in the original New York production of the Kurt Weill Bertolt Brecht musical The Three Penny Opera. And this was the production that Mark Blitzstein wrote the translation for. It's a really famous production. Really
ran for 5 years.
Yeah, and the cast recording is still around and still, of course, wonderful. I want to play your duet with Bea Arthur, who eventually became known for her TV role as Maud, and then for her role on The Golden Girls. And this is called the Jealousy Duet because you're both
after Mac the Knife,
exactly,
of course.
Exactly. So we're going to pick this up in the part where you're singing the main part, because it kind of alternates between the two of you. So here it is from the Three Penny Opera. My guest, Joe Sullivan Lesser, and Bea Arthur.
Yes, they call me Beauty of the Town. See my legs and say, now those are pretty. I'm glad you're glad to admire beauty. Not the tree must dangle in the city.
Go peddle your wares somewhere else.
I knew I would make a big impression on my Mackie.
Oh, did you?
You'd be pleased to know I've met his Jackie.
Have you?
Well, you kind of make me laugh.
Now I kind of make you laugh.
Who would want a big giraffe?
Who would want what big giraffe?
Ah, you are so pitiful, imagining you're beautiful.
Bet you wouldn't ask him.
Certainly I'll ask him.
Go on then, ask him.
You better ask him.
A big, complete girl.
Him leave me falling, sweet girl.
Asinine.
That's my guest, Joe Sullivan Lesser, along with Bea Arthur from the Three Penny Opera production with the original New York production with lyrics translated by Mark Blitzstein. Now, one of the amazing things about this production is that Kurt Weill's widow, Lottie Lenya, was in it. And, you know, watching, after you married Frank Lesser, did you kind of think back to your experiences with Lottie Lenya and how, what her relationship was like with her husband and his work? I know he had already passed away by the time you were in the Three Penny Opera, but still, what she must have spoken to you about what it had been like to work with her husband.
She spoke very little about that. I know that I stood in the wings and watched her all the time because she was superb. The woman was absolutely superb. And a few years, I started to sing Frank songs by then in clubs at the ballroom and in hotels and concerts, etc. And I would never talk about him. I just didn't feel like, I could say anything, you know, like, he always liked to wear a blue shirt and all things that he did. And so I went to hear Lottie, and she talked all about Kurt Weill, and she told many stories about him, how he worked and what kind of a person he was and their relationship. And I said, and I was fascinated. It was so interesting. And I said, I'm going to do that from now on. So I started talking all about Frank, about how he would work and how he'd get up at, you know, at 12 o'clock at night and his martini in the morning, and that he always loved blue shirts and always wore them. And he would write notes. He drew, I must say, beautifully. And he would write me a note and make it like an airplane and throw it through the door, and they'd say, are you ready to go out now? How about it's 8 o'clock? And I have 300 of his drawings that are wonderful, musing. He had great, great wit, drawings, and I talked to him about his drawings and showed some of his drawings and did some songs that weren't famous and all of that sort of thing. And Lenya's the one that helped me do that because I saw how interesting it was to know those things.
Well, I'm glad you've kept alive your memories of him and have shared them, and thank you for sharing some of them with us today. Are you still singing?
I haven't, no. I have. I'm running the business, and I have two daughters, and I'm busy with them. So I haven't sung in 2 years. I don't know if I'll sing again or not. I'd love to sing. It's great, but I'll see. I'll see.
Thank you so much for talking with us.
And thank you so much for asking me. I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Joe Sullivan Lesser starred in the original 1956 production of Frank Lesser's musical, The Most Happy Fella. It's currently being performed by the New York City Opera. The star is Paul Sorvino. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Shurrock. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. Here's more from the original cast recording of The Most Happy Fella. Two songs from the show became popular, Joey and Standin' on the Corner.
Standin' on the corner, watching all the girls go by. Matter of fact, neither do I. Then standing on the corner, watching all the girls, watching all the girls, watching all the girls go by. I'm the cat that got the cream. Haven't got a girl, but I can dream.
Support for NPR comes from United Artists and Sony Pictures Classics, presenting Capote, starring Philip Seymour Hoffman, available on DVD March 21st. From the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. And from Capella University, an accredited university offering more than 20 doctoral degree programs online at capella.edu. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Kevin Phillips worked in the Nixon administration, but he's become a critic of the Republican Party. On the next Fresh Air, Phillips talks about his new book, American Theocracy, The Peril and Politics of Radical Religion, Oil, and Borrowed Money in the 21st Century. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.